We're talking with George Anastasia, the author of Gotti's Rules, a fascinating book. It looks at the inside workings of the Gambino crime family. And as George just reminded me, he's also the author of a book called Being Oscar, which is about the colorful life of our former mayor in Las Vegas, Oscar Goodman, who was a mob attorney for a lot of years and learned quite a bit about how these things operated himself. When we come back, we'll talk about why John A. Light went on the run, where he went, and then we'll open up the phone lines with a couple of your questions from my guests. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. George, before the break, you were starting to describe how things started going south for John A. Light, and he sort of could see the handwriting on the wall. There was a plot to kill him. There was a plot to kill Junior Gotti, and he sort of got a warning from some feds, right?
Yeah, the FBI, when they learn about a murder contract, they're obligated to tell the intended target. So he got a visit from two FBI agents, and they told him he had a problem. They wouldn't tell him specifically. They don't tell you that, but they said, "You've got a problem, and if you want to come talk to us, think about coming in and cooperating. We'd be happy to talk to you." And he basically said, "Thanks, but no thanks." But what he did, I mean, this is indicative of the way he works the system. A. Light informed one of Gotti Jr.'s lawyers that he was going in to see the FBI because they had got this tip about a murder contract on him. And then afterwards, he told everybody that he could that the FBI had played a tape in which he heard three people, Carmine Agnello, Peter Gotti, and a third person who he believed to be Junior Gotti, talking on a tape about killing him. Now, that was false. It never happened. But A. Light said his thinking was, "I know they were planning to kill me. I figured if they thought there was a tape, that would put them off, because if anything happened to me, they would assume they would be the first people the FBI would go to." So he was buying some time by putting that word out. And as I said, A. Light was very astute at how to work and play the system. So, you know, he was setting things up. He transferred a lot of cash to some banks in Canada because he learned it would be easier to funnel that money to Europe that way than if anybody tried to freeze his assets in the United States. And ultimately, he knew an indictment was pending in Tampa. He decided to take off. And he took a girlfriend on a trip to Santa Lucia for 6 days. And at the end of the vacation, he said, "You go back to Florida, I'm taking off." And he went, I think, first to one of the Caribbean islands, and then into Jamaica, then into Cuba, and then he ended up in Europe for a while, bouncing around Barcelona, Paris. His wife, his common-law wife, visited him in Paris. He went in and out of Albania once or twice. I think he went to Greece once. He was in Italy. And then he went back to South America, in Colombia, Venezuela, and ultimately settled in Brazil. At first, he was in Bahia, which is in the north of Brazil, and he said he liked it, but it was kind of rough around the edges, and he stood out too much as an American. And people there told him he'd be better off down in Rio, because there, you know, it's a lot of visitors, a lot of tourists, that kind of stuff. And he settled in Copacabana and was there for almost a year before he got arrested. And
Yeah,
lived
he's
a
living
very
in
good life.
style too. I mean, you describe it. He's having a pretty good time. He's got a lot of money. I don't know how much he had put away, but he's got a lot of money, and he's not like some fugitive hiding out and in terror. He's living a good life.
Yeah, I think it was several million dollars he had access to. He didn't have it all with him, but he had access to it. And he wasn't afraid to spend it. And as I said, he thoroughly enjoyed it. Learned a lot of different languages and had a good time. And if you know some of the pictures in the book, there's one picture of him on a camel in Senegal, because he had gone into Senegal in Africa to get some phony passports, which helped him move around. There's pictures of him with his common-law wife in Paris, pictures of him with his girlfriend in Brazil, and with other girls in Colombia. Lived well, traveled, and enjoyed himself. And if it didn't all come apart, he probably would still be out there somewhere. I mean, he's frankly admits that he got arrested and spent 2 years in a Brazilian prison fighting extradition. And he told me his plan was, first he thought he would make bail. If he made bail, he was going to take off. And he said, "I was either going to go to Venezuela or Cuba, He said, I probably should have settled in one of those countries anyway because there's no extradition. But he said, I was fascinated with Brazil. He never got bail, and he thought he could beat the extradition case. He couldn't. And ultimately, after 2 years of horrific time in Brazilian prisons, and he describes that in detail, what life was like in those Brazilian prisons, he got extradited to Florida. And once he got back, he had already heard rumors that Junior Gotti was cooperating. He said at least a dozen other guys he was close to had given him up. And he said, you know, what am I being a stand-up guy for? For what? Who am I being loyal to? And that's when he cut his deal and decided to cooperate.
You would say, you know, he sort of had a psychic sense. He knew that the walls were closing in on him here. And then he also had sort of an inkling that maybe it was time to get moving down there in Brazil. And the same day he was going to leave is when he was pinched.
Exactly. He said he stayed a little too long and he got a little too comfortable, but he was leaving that day. He said, I should have left earlier, but I was leaving that day. And all of a sudden, he said, there was a helicopter overhead and the traffic stopped. It got real quiet. It's in the middle of the afternoon. And all of a sudden, the SWAT team is popping up around the corner and they all come at him with the automatic weapons and bulletproof vests and helmets. And, you know, he's told to kneel down and then he's taken into custody. And he spent the next 12 years in prison, either in Brazil or over here.
It sounds like that prison down there, it reminded me of, like, I know it's a different country, but the Midnight Express. I mean, it sounds really bad. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, because I thought of that movie when I was listening to him tell the stories. And like anything else, though, I mean, he said if you had money in prison, you could reach accommodations. And, you know, there were a group of guards that the prisoners were paying off. There were a group of guards that were loyal to the warden. The warden and the assistant warden were running a canteen out of which prisoners were supposed to buy food and toiletries at exorbitant prices. A light and his guys, he hooked up with some guys from the Red Command, which is the Brazilian mafia, for want of a better term, and he hooked up with some international criminals that were in there. They had some money. They were able to bribe some guards, and so it was back and forth. They would smuggle food in. He talked about how after 2 or 3 months when he first made the connection and they smuggled in pizzas and hamburgers, he said he ate till he got sick because he had been living on rice and beans, but he was gorging himself. It was a horrific experience, but it was, again, indicative of, I think, his character. He's a survivor. And once he got over the depression of being in there, because he admits, when I first got in, I didn't know if I was ever getting out. But once he got over that depression, then he figured out, how am I going to survive? How am I going to prosper? And how am I going to get over on this? And he spent a lot of money doing that, and he had a plan. It's just that he got extradited before he could put any of the escape in. And move into a different country. Before he could put that into play, he got extradited to Florida.
As you describe in the book, this prison, once he figures out how it works, he makes some friends, he's spread some money around, and it's a lot easier to survive and get what you need in there. But he gets in trouble with the warden because the warden had his own side business running, and since he wasn't buying things from the warden was mad at him.
Yeah, and again, the book, in fact, the book opens, the first chapter opens with that situation. He's in prison. They're going to send some prison guards and trustees to take him out of the cell. He's in the cell with about 16, 20 guys. They're going to take him, they're going to strip him and take him to what they call a dry cell, which is where they take guys when they beat him up. And he said, you know, he could have been killed. He didn't know what was going to happen. And one of the leaders of the Red Command, the Brazilian mafia guy, said, look, here's what you got to do. So they get a knife and they wrap it in rag, and they soak the rag in oil and a light secretes the knife in his body cavity. And when they strip him, he's still got the knife on him, and they throw him into this dry cell in the dark. Two trustees are going to come in and beat the hell out of him, but they let him sit in the dark for a while. And he squats down, pulls out the knife, and he's told me this story 2 or 3 times. He starts doing calisthenics and letting his eyes adjust to the dark, and he's doing squat thrusts, and he's moving around, getting a sense of it's a 10 by 10 cell. He puts the soaking rag in a corner so he doesn't slip on it. And when the trustee comes in with a blackjack, a big bulky guy who was pumped up on steroids, he comes in, a light slams the cell door shut. So now the trustee's in the dark, his eyes don't adjust, and a light starts lashing out at him with a knife and leaves the guy a bloody mess, opens the door and walks out of the cell, and there's another trustee there, and he sees a light naked and covered in blood. He screams and takes off. And a light says, he walked back to the cell block, and an inmate from one of the other cells says, "Gringo, give me the knife." And Elliot said, at first I didn't know what he meant. And then I realized, they said, I gave him the knife and then I went back to my cell. So when the other guards came to search, they wouldn't find the knife.
Right.
I mean, that's the way the book opens. And again, it's the story of John A. Light as a survivor. John A. Light doing whatever you had to do to survive. I mean, that story to me epitomized everything about him.
Well, there's a heck of a lot of details, and if we have time a little bit later, I want to talk about him coming back and testifying against Junior Gotti, because, you know, it's in a way that the dad was the Teflon Don, but Junior Gotti dodged a few bullets himself there. But we'll take a couple of calls from listeners who are on the line. First one is a first-time caller named Joe, who's calling from Queens, so maybe he's got some insight for us. Joe, how you doing? Welcome to the program.
Good. You know, I just seen the movie The Gambler with James Caan, and you know, about the addicted gambler and a little bit of a tie-up with the mob and, you know, the heavy-duty sports betting, and I'm wondering what the thoughts were on that movie, that character, and, you know, just sports betting in general as a tie into this.
Well, you know, I think we talked about that earlier. I mean, I think the smart mob guys make a lot of money off degenerate gamblers, and they play off of that. And it's a combination of sports, taking sports bet, and then loan sharking. That's where the big money is. And I think it works best when you've got a guy who's addicted to gambling, because he cannot not bet, and he's going to get whatever money he can get from wherever he can get it. I mean, that's the way. Someone once told me that sports book and loan sharking are the economic wheels around which the traditional mafia operates, and the smart guys stay in those businesses because there's a lot of money can be made. So I think that movie, the whole concept of the addicted gambler is the dark side of all of that, you know, and I think it's a very, very accurate depiction.
How much money is involved in all this, though? How much?
Well, I mean, you know, we just finished the Super Bowl Sunday, and George would know this. I mean, Vegas. They probably took estimates of 90 to 100 million in action on Super Bowl Sunday. Overall estimates are $3 to $4 billion is bet on Super Bowl Sunday,
just on that game.
Right. Now half of that might go on legitimate or quasi-legitimate internet gambling, 100 million to Vegas. You got another $2 billion sitting there. Where does that go? It goes to the mob bookmakers. I mean, it's, you know, I talked to a gambler one time who said Super Bowl Sunday is, it's the end of the season. It's either you get even or you get even worse. I mean, that's what Super Bowl is. You know.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Wild card line, William in Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi, William. You're on with George Anastasia.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. believe it or not, I played a major role in getting U.S. Congress and President Nixon to enact the Racketeering, Influence, and Corrupt Organizations, RICO Act, 1970. Act helped to control criminal syndicates, mafias. The reason I'm calling is, and the reason why I got involved in this was because when I was young, I got involved in politics. I'm a retired cancer researcher myself. Everything. But there's Wikipedia, and there's a term in there, Minnesota Nice. And I wanted to edit that. And I was banned from being able to edit Minnesota Nice, that phrase, by Vituli, Vito. He's a Sicilian from Italy. Minnesota Nice, here's what I wanted to put in. Their phrase was first used by organized crime mobs or mafias to describe some good-looking boys, but mostly beautiful blonde girls, that were sent to be used in acts of pedophilia or prostitution from Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, to New York in the 1920s through the 1970s. One mob mafia was headed by a naturalized Sicilian living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's dead now, Bella Stryrie. He headed the mafia for Wisconsin, Kansas, Minnesota. And the other mob was headed by, I'm not going to mention an ethnic group, but you can guess, living in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And That, you know, so that's good. And so I've been banned now. I cannot edit or do anything when Wikipedia up through 2018, January 2018, just because I wanted to bring that out. Minnesota Nice was used originally to describe boys and girls.
Hey, William, do you have a question for George?
Okay, let me ask you this. Is there a possibility that there are different organized crime groups in America that are helping to bring down America, not just the Sicilian mafias, but other mafias too? And thank you.
Thanks, William.
I don't think it's a question of bringing down America. This is an interesting question, though. I mean, the big issue right now with law enforcement is obviously terrorism, and that's replaced, I think, the focus. And the difference between terrorists and organized crime figures, I think, simply put, is this: you look at the mafia. The mafia's purpose is to corrupt the system and to benefit from the corruption, but it's important for the system to function. Terrorists want to take down the system. They don't care. And so it's a different kind of problem. And so I wouldn't say that there are mafia organized crime organizations working to take down America. I think there are terrorist groups that certainly are, but it's a different agenda.
Let me ask it a different way, George. You've followed the mob for 30 years. What's left of it? You know, you think, just at the point you think, well, the mafia's got to be gone. I mean, they've busted just about everybody there is. It certainly has been depleted here in Las Vegas. But every once in a while, you'll hear about the FBI raiding a couple of dozen mob guys. Is there still a Gambino family, a Genovese family? Are they still active?
I think they're always going to exist. It's just that the American Mafia is not the monolithic institution it was in the 40s and 50s. It's one of the players in the underworld. But, you know, we've talked earlier about Russian organized crime. There are Hispanic drug gangs, Asian gangs, South American gangs. All of those organizations are players in, I guess it's a multicultural and ethnic underworld in America now. The Mafia is a part of that. I don't think the Mafia will ever disappear. But it's never going to be the giant that it was back in the day.
Yeah, here in the West, you got the Mexican cartels that control most of the drug trade, and that's where the big money is. But here in Las Vegas, you've got Asian mafia guys, even Israeli mob the Yakuza that still shows up, Chinese triads, different guys carving out different pieces of territory.
Absolutely. It's all about chasing the money. Then you got corporate America, and you make an argument that it's a different kind of organized crime. You know,
so. They make the real big money.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I saw this article. We're going to go to a break here in about a minute. I saw an article about the Junior Gotti book. And, of course, John Alight, your guy, testified against Junior. Junior beat the rap. I mean, he beat it two or three times, maybe four times. And now he's come out with his own version where he says Alight was a non-Italian associate, the bottom of the totem pole. Not a denizen of Bergen. He says, after seeing all the surveillance tapes taken of the Bergen, which is a club where the Gottis were, you would only see him once or twice going in. What do you say to that?
I mean, Junior, again, is trying to control the narrative. I think it's been documented inside and out that Alight was his guy. And we can talk about the trials after the break, but yeah, he testified. Junior fought the feds to a draw four different times. Never
Amazing.
Beat the rap. Hung juries are four different cases.
We'll get into that in a moment here. We're talking with George Anastasia about his book, Gotti's Rules. Still a lot to come and still a lot of folks on the phones. We'll get to more right after this on Coast to Coast. The Valentine's Day holiday is a really big one for the Mob Museum here in Las Vegas. It marked its third anniversary this year. And, of course, the Valentine's connection is the museum here has the actual wall from the Valentine's Day Massacre, where it was in a garage where a bunch of guys were gunned down back in the bloody Chicago mob era. And the actual bricks from that wall are here in the museum in Las Vegas, and you can see the bullet holes and everything. So there is a sort of a mob connection to the Valentine's Day holiday. And there is a certain mob chic that we still see in evidence. If you click on a television, you see the mob wives. The Sopranos was such a popular show. There are different reality shows where this stuff pops up. Even that Donald Trump show, I think Vicky Gotti made an appearance on The Apprentice. So maybe we'll ask our guest a little bit about that, the mob chic, and why there's a continuing fascination with it, then get to as many of your questions. Several of you have been hanging on the line for a while, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Our final segment with George Anastasia, whose new book, Gotti's Rules, is a fascinating look at the inner workings of mafia and sort of how it went down. We're going to go back to the phone lines east of the Rockies, Ty in North Dakota. Hi, Ty. You're on with George. Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, George, I've done a little research on this, and I'm sure you probably know this name, but a lot of people don't. What do you know about Anthony Gaspipe Casso, and what can you tell us?
So, George, do you know that name?
Yeah, sure. He was on the underboss of the Lucchese crime family. Very brutal guy. In fact, he was behind a couple of the attempts on Gotti Sr. And he also was the guy who was running those mafia cops that were carrying out a couple murders and feeding information. Casso tried to be a cooperator after he was convicted, and the deal fell apart. And he's serving a life term right now. Yeah, very, very brutal guy, very tough guy, and part of the Lucchese organization. I'm not sure if anybody's written a book about him or someone's talked about writing a book about him, but he, I think, epitomizes it as Gotti Sr. did. The reason the mob has come apart, it's, you know, violence for violence's sake. It's not a way to run an organization.
Ty, did you have some personal interest in this gas pipe guy?
No, I'm a former correctional officer. I was only a corrections officer for a short time, but while I was, you know, we were taught about gangs and mobs and, you know, the mentality behind them, you know, anybody that is affiliated with such organizations. And Mr. Casso's name came up in discussion, and along with, you know, John Gotti and people of the like. So I hadn't heard George mention him in all this, and so I just kind of wanted to see if there was, you know, any additional information that he could bring up into the conversation, I guess.
Well, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. I guess any guy named Gaspipe, you got to see some dark imagery there. You mentioned in the book a couple of times Sammy the Bull, but I don't remember any kind of interaction between Gravano and A-Lite. Was there much?
Not much. I mean, it's funny. A-Lite says Sammy claimed a lot of murders, but actually never carried out murders personally. He only killed one or two guys, as if that's something to, you know.
Yeah, only one or two. Yeah.
Yeah. Your bona fides. You know, Gravano was implicated, I think, in 20 murders, but A-Lite says he only actually pulled the trigger once or twice. I mean, there's not much A-Lite can say about Gravano, because A-Lite did exactly what Gravano did: cut a deal with the government and testified. So.
West of the Rockies, Tim in Phoenix. Hi, Tim. You're on with George Anastasia.
Hi. Hey, how are you doing, guys?
Okay.
Good.
Well, it's kind of an observation. In the 80s, I worked at an Italian restaurant out here in Phoenix. Very popular, but kind of out-of-the-way place. And you would have people throwing their money around and acting like they were big shots. And I was a waiter there. And one night I waited on a family of like five people. And one of the head waiters said, "Do you know who you just waited on?" I said, "No." He goes, "That's a big mob family of Arizona."
Bonanno?
I don't know what their name was. But here's my point, is that it was like waiting on a middle-class family. They'd dress up. They weren't loud. They kept to themselves. In other words, they weren't wannabes. And what they did is they basically kept really, really low key. You would think they, you know, like Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah. Well, you see, you know, that's interesting. There's a stereotype that people have of the mob and the perception. And my experience has been that wise guys are as diverse and different as lawyers or doctors. Some of them are funny, some of them are nice, some of them are arrogant. You know, they have a life outside of their job, so to speak. I remember a wise guy in Philadelphia who was a degenerate gambler. And on a Sunday, this one Sunday, he had, I think, $10,000 on the Eagles. Well, the Eagles were playing. But his six-year-old daughter had a soccer game that day. So he had to go watch his daughter play soccer instead of sitting at home in front of the TV, you know, watching the Eagles where he had 10 grand riding. You know, we sometimes lose sight of that. These guys have lives. And to say that the family was low-key and, you know, respectful, that doesn't surprise me. There were people like that. Other guys, they want you to know who they are, and they expect special treatment. But you could probably say the same thing about lawyers or doctors or actors, you know. It's don't put these guys in a stereotypical pigeonhole. They're all different. I mean, A. Light was different than Junior Gotti, and Senior Gotti was different than Vincent Gigante.
Well, you know, what I'm trying to say is some of these people that came in the restaurant that thought they were high flyers were really nothing.
And well, you got posers.
Posers. You know, they knew better than to, you know, bring attention to themselves.
Yeah, well, if you're the real deal, you don't have to. That's
right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. You know, you mentioned about how the regular life, I think A. Light developed a friendship with an FBI guy through the strangest place. It was like Little League or something?
The FBI's grandson and A. Light's son were both playing ice hockey on teams that practiced at the same rink. They were 10 and 11 years old. The FBI agent's name was Dave Gentile. I know him very well. He's based in Philadelphia. And he got to know John just talking about hockey and talking about their kids. And ultimately, John confided in him, and Dave tried to convince John to become a cooperator before he went on the run. And John said, listen, I appreciate what you're saying, but that's not for me. And I've talked to Dave. In fact, I had dinner with Dave and John about a month ago. Dave is retired now but still living in the area. Very good guy. And, they met at an ice hockey rink where Dave's grandson and John's son were both playing ice hockey.
So they're friends now, or they at least socialize?
Yeah. They're friends now, and Dave, much the way I was saying earlier, Dave hopes that John has turned his life around.
That's tough, though, isn't it? I mean, I think about somebody like Henry Hill, who in Goodfellas, he turns and entered the witness protection program and can never keep himself out of trouble. It's tough to turn away from that life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that Henry Hill never stopped being Henry Hill, and it goes to what you were saying right before the break. I mean, a lot of these guys have turned it around and made it a brand, and that they market it. Henry Hill marketed the mafia, you know, after, you know, he was living out in California and doing appearances. So some of these guys, that's what Mob Wives is all about. It's the marketing, growing up Gotti.
Can you watch those shows? I mean, it's hard, isn't it?
I tried to watch Mob Wives the other day because there's a connection I'm trying to develop, but I can't watch it. They're just awful. They really are. They're terrible.
There's no getting around the mob chic, though. I mean, it'll always be a hot topic and sexy topic.
Yeah, I mean, there's a friend of mine, a gangster named Danny Provenzano in North Jersey, who had a recurring role on The Housewives of New Jersey one season because they wanted that mafia buzz to be part of the show. So Danny would show up and get a paycheck and, you know, go on camera. It was all scripted, though. It's not reality.
Sure.
But, yeah, the mafia is a brand now, and people are trying to market it. And there's a market for it. I mean, people are interested. People have this perception, I think, because of the Godfather movies and the books. I mean, they were wonderful books and movies, but they were fiction.
First-time caller, Bob in South Florida. Hi, Bob. You're on with George Anastasia.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Bob. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. What's on your mind?
Yeah, go ahead. Great. Yeah, I'm hoping I can speak to Mr. Anastasia.
He's on the phone.
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, he's on the line.
Go ahead. Okay. There was one name that never came up with the indictment, John A. Light, down in Tampa. Hello?
Yeah, we're listening.
Go ahead. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about the man that runs Tampa down there. You know his name, George?
No.
Well, I mean, I know who used to, Santos Traficante. I mean, that's a long time ago, but...
That goes back in the day, yeah.
Yeah.
I meant the guy who took over after him.
I don't know who it is. Who is it?
I don't know if I want to say his name. Oh, no, yeah, I haven't even given my real name. But I can tell
you... Here's the thing. A light was down there as part of a Gambino crew. I don't know if they interacted with this fellow that you're referring to or not, but it's conceivable. Given
he was indicted with a
way Florida is. I mean, all the New York families have a presence down there.
He was indicted with a man named Terry Scaglione, right, Mr. Anastasia?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. He was one of the co-defendants in that case, yeah.
Terry Scaglione. I know who Terry was recently released a few years ago.
Right.
Well, I want to say a year ago. And his presence has been felt. Oh, my God. Can't believe you're saying this. But, he was down there last year. I saw him.
John basically said he's out of that life now, but John was very familiar with the players down there in the whole Pampa, Florida area. And he mentioned that individual you just mentioned a couple times. So, but that's, you know, again, John keeps saying that's in his past. That's not who he is now. That's who he was. So there may be guys out there who still want to be part of that life, but the message from John A. Light is there's no future in that. Don't go back there. You end up dead or in jail.
So, Bob, let me ask you this. Are you in the life somehow? Are you involved in this stuff?
Yes. As a fringe player, yeah. I can say yeah.
Well, did you know A. Light? Were you around when he was there?
No, I've been around for the post-A. Light, the post-A. Light era.
Okay.
I don't know how many people are out there listening. I could get into a lot of serious shit letting his name drop. I mean, I could.
Well, yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. So, but the point of A. Light's message is, it's not worth being involved. So you ought to think about that. What's the upside of what you're doing, and what's the downside? And that's what if John were talking to you right now, that's what he would say. Look, he would say, I've been there, I know what it's about, and at the end of the day, it's not worth what you gain is not worth what you end up giving up. So think about that. I mean, I don't, you know. That's just secondhand advice that I'm sending to you by way of John A. Light, who's been where you are, you know.
Bob, thank you for calling. You want to say anything else?
No, just I wanted to call to speak to you guys, but you asked if the mobs were still active. They were still very active families. I want to tell you, yes, they are very active. They're still active in, all across the board. I don't see things going away. I don't see things changing for a while, like Mr. Anastasia said. But anyway,
there's money to be made. There's money to be made, so people are going to go where the money is. Yeah.
Very true, very true. There was a couple of rumors I'd like to could drop, but I decided I don't feel comfortable doing it over the air.
Don't put yourself in a bad position. I understand what you're saying.
Hey, Bob, we have links to George Anastasia on the Coast to Coast website. You could communicate that way, and don't get yourself in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Do that.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Tell me a little bit about A-Light now. I mean, how is he able to make a living? Has he got some money still put away?
He claims he doesn't. I don't know if that's true, but he's giving talks to teenage organizations. He's got a little construction business where he and some associates are trying to rehab some buildings, and he's anywhere near where he was financially. And in fact, he struggles to pay his rent every month, living in an apartment in the middle of New Jersey. And I think one of the reasons he can't make any money on this book because of Son of Sam. I mean, he can only.
Oh, yeah.
$10,000. I think I paid him $8,600 for his time and that he put into this. That's the extent of what he can make. I think he's hoping something comes out of this, that somebody comes along and wants to make a movie or do something on cable, and separate from the book, they'd have to pay him as a consultant or something. I think that's part of his thinking.
Is he able to see his family? Is his family with him?
He's estranged from one of his sons, but he's very close to two sons.
that he had with Claudia, his common law wife. He's, the last time I spoke with him, he was with Claudia. And he's got a relationship with his daughter from his first wife. His son from his first wife, he's estranged from. He's trying to rebuild those connections. So, yeah, I mean, he sees his two sons, John and Matt, all the time. They're very close to him. And, you know, he's trying to make up for what he lost and what he kind of threw away. He realizes that now. So in that light, when I see him that way, I hope he succeeds, and I genuinely like the guy. On the other hand, I know who he was, what he did, and he doesn't try to hide that. It's a struggle. And like I said, he goes to therapy at least once a week.
You say, I think in the book you said that he still goes back to the old neighborhoods here and there. I mean, he's saying, come and get me, here I am.
Well, it's not so much come and get me as I'm not afraid. You didn't chase me out of Queens. Because Gotti Jr. keeps saying we chased him out of Queens. It's like a neighborhood thing. And A. Light says, nobody chased me out of Queens. I go back whenever I want. And he does go back. He went back with there was a British documentary that's going to air, I think, in Britain in March. They went back up there. They filmed him right on the streets in his old neighborhood. He did a thing with 60 Minute Sports about sports betting. He went back to Queens. He's gone up there to restaurants. He's gone to clubs in Manhattan. He's not hiding. He's been in Atlantic City. He is who he is. And I think part of that is, you know, you can't go back to the gangster life, but I think the adrenaline rush that you get when you know you're always got to be on the alert, always got to be conscious of who you're with and who you're around, I think he still gets a rush from that. And that's another reason he doesn't want to leave the area.
Was he listening tonight? Is he listening?
I don't know. Well, he knew. I don't know. It's 5 o'clock. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if he stayed up all that time, George. He knew we were doing this and he was going to try, but he's got other things going on. He's struggling.
Well, if he listens to the replay at some point, we'll invite him on the program. If he ever feels up to it, we'll come back with you.
All right, I'll tell him that. Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
What else are you working on? Something cool? Something fun?
I'd like to do something on the drug underworld. It's a little bit harder sell, but I think if we're talking about the underworld today, that's where it is. That's where the money is. That's where the guns are. That's where the violence is. If you want to talk about what's ripping apart American cities, it's the drug culture. It's not the mafia.
So. George Anastasia, I really like the book. It's good stuff. If you're interested, anyone who's interested in the mafia and in Gotti, you got to check out Gotti's Rules. And hope you'll come back and talk to us again sometime.
Absolutely will, George. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a fun book. So if this is a topic that interests you, check it out. Also want to thank my earlier guest, Miriam Linna, with her book about the life and strange deaths of Bobby Fuller. Thanks to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Tricia Pepe, Nathan Staten, Dan Galati, webmaster Tim Banal, and our producer Chris Boros. Next Saturday, I will be at the UFO Congress in Arizona to introduce and interview Bob Lazar, and then Sunday night, Jacques Vallée here on Coast to Coast. Hope you can join us then. Good night, everyone.